Welcome to the All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. On tonight's show, Debbie Irving, racial justice educator and writer, tackles the topic of race in America from the perspective of white privilege. Of all the shows this year, this week's All Souls Forum has done the most to give me a deeper understanding the role race might have played in last fall's presidential election. While this may not be the specific goal of the speaker's presentation tonight, Irving exposes some of the false assumptions that might be behind the concept of Make America Great Again, and why some aspire for the America of the past and others fear returning to it. Having an idyllic white suburban upbringing in an upper middle class family, Irving was unaware that many of her beliefs about who she was as a white woman in relation to people of color were based on false assumptions perpetuated by her family, advertising, the media, and the greater American culture in general. These assumptions created harmful and archaic belief patterns about people of color, patterns that even the well-intentioned like herself fell into. On this week's show, Irving will explain how white privilege can subtly perpetuate racism at the individual, institutional, and societal level. The fascinating process of her own awakening to racism's effects helped give Irving insight into why her earlier efforts to be a good person and help people of color often weren't received in the way they were intended. This show was recorded on Sunday, April 30th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Tonight's show will not include questions and answers from the audience. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. I don't know how many of you were it or not, but this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and today, conference held downtown. It's called the White Privilege Conference. I was privileged to not only volunteer, but attend a lot of sessions, and it was wonderful. For one reason, it was not all white, and it was not all black, and it was the most diverse group of people I have ever seen. And it was fantastic being able to talk to such a wide group of people and learn. Anyway, we're fortunate today to have one of the session presenters. Debbie, I'm going to read this because I'm not good at some of this. Debbie Irving is a racial justice educator and the author of an acclaimed book, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. She is a presenter at the White Privilege Conference this week and in the past. She's also done conferences such as NCORE, the National Summit for Courageous Conversation, and the People of Color Conference. Debbie has also appeared on numerous television and radio programs throughout the country, notably in MSNBC and TED Talks. I'll go through the rules about questions. Without further ado, Debbie Irving.
I am horrible with names, Debbie.
See, we're not supposed to be able to do anything by ourselves. We're supposed to be in community and partnership.
Hi, everybody. And I'm so honored to be here. This is the first time I've stepped out of the conference center since I got here. I don't even know what day it is. I'm kind of in that weird conference space. So what I'm going to be talking to you about today is the kind of thing that I talk to faith communities and school districts and universities and colleges and corporations and nonprofit foundations all across the country about. The name of this is I'm a Good Person, Isn't That Enough? But that's actually not the tone that it's meant to be read with. It's meant to be said like this. I'm a good person. Isn't that enough? And the reason it has that snarky tone on it is because I realized that's close to the way those words played in my head for years. So my story, which you'll hear more about, is I grew up in a white suburb north of Boston, then went to an all-white college in Ohio, Kenyon College, and then I started a career in arts and education in Boston and Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was on diversity committees for 25 years. Often I would get this feeling of I wasn't, like maybe there was some elephant in the room. I wasn't sure what it was. I felt this tension whenever I was interacting with a person of color, terrified of saying something wrong, saying something stupid. A lot of times I felt like maybe I wasn't that appreciated for being there. And the thought that would run through my head was like, you know, I'm a good person. Isn't that enough? When my book came out, And I would go to bookstores and book talks around the country. Inevitably, at the end of every talk, someone would come up and say, you know, I think we just need to be good people. We just need to love each other because we're all the same. You know, if we cut, we all bleed the same color on the inside. So that's what it's about. And I thought, wow, that's really where I got myself stuck. That kind of what I would call colorblind mindset. I really did think being a good person was enough. And I was a little irritated there was a suggestion I should do anything more. And that's why it's the tone, I'm a good person. Isn't that enough? Like, I showed up to this diversity committee. What else do you want? I wouldn't have said any of that. This is all this very kind of shameful internal dialogue that I'm getting in touch with. So let's explore this question. I'm a good person. Isn't that enough? I mean, what more could we possibly want? Okay. The easy answer is nope, it's not enough. So if you're here for the short version, you want to go back to bed, this is where you would leave. But hopefully you're going to really stick around with me because this is really challenging stuff that I'm going to be talking about. We're going to go there, and we're going to explore, wait, why isn't being a good person enough? Well, the first thing that we have to contend with in that sentence, I'm a good person, is what's good? And who gets to decide what good is? It's actually a really subjective idea, you know, if we're talking about good grammar, good behavior, good clothing, good hair, what's beautiful, what's right, what's wrong, you know, all of these are incredibly subjective. So what are we going to do if you have one version of good? I have another version of good, and how are we even going to negotiate that? If you're my boss, we'll have to go with your version. So the second you take anything that is subjective, the person or the group of people in power are the ones who have the power and the privilege to determine what's good, what's right, what's wrong, what's beautiful, and to kind of tell the story about all of that. So even though I might think, the golden rule, you know, treat others the way I want to be treated, that might not feel so good to other people. The thing that people in my racial justice world say is the platinum rule, teach others the way they would like to be treated. So how do we even know that? So those are the limitations of trying to say, I'm a good person. Who gets to decide what's good and what's not? Okay, one thing I want to talk about is how is it possible that we could have different understandings of a simple word like good? Well, you're going to find out I'm a very enthusiastic Googler in the course of this presentation, and I put in the words belief system, and this is what came up. And I love it because this image speaks to the closed-circuit loopness that a belief system is, meaning that we will use what's already in our belief systems to make meaning of what comes at us, conversations we have, people we encounter. So what's in our belief systems is crucial, and here's the crazy thing about our belief systems. What's in there, most of what's in there got laid down by the time we were 5 or 10 years old, and from that point forward, what we do is we collect information in support of what we already believe. Peggy McIntosh, who's another person speaking at the conference, a well-known racial justice educator, she talks about our belief system being like our little private hard drives. We are stuck with that hard drive. We only get one childhood hard drive. You can never go back and change it out and create a new one. But what you can do is write and rewrite software throughout your adult life to help you navigate and manage what's in there. So what you're going to learn in my story, I'm going to share with you how my belief system got built and how full of flaws it was. Errors, omissions, and flat-out myths. So every one of you could be up here. You could be telling your story about what's in your belief system. You could do it through a class lens, a geography lens, a racial lens. I'm going to be talking about mine through a racial lens. Whoops, this is me. As a little kid, I have no idea my belief system's being built. I just want to eat my little chocolate pudding in front of me. As I tell my racial story, which is a white racial story, also woven into it, inevitably, are other identities I have. So the era I was born in 1960, the geography, raised north of Boston in a suburb, class. I am from an upper-class family, Protestant, 5 children, 1 mom, 1 dad, dad worked, mom stayed at home. So all of those things influence the way I'm experiencing my racial identity that I don't even know I have yet. So here I am, and I'm growing up in Winchester, Massachusetts, as I said, just north of Boston. Now, if you had showed me this image before I started waking up white, which, by the way, would have been 9 years ago, that's when this all started for me, and you said, this is where you grew up? Whoa, I look at that and all I see is racism. I would have said, and I wouldn't have said it, I would have thought, A, that is ridiculous, And B, why would you say something like that? Like, that is just divisive and agitating and stirring the pot. It's comments like that that are the problem. If you don't already see what I'm saying, which I bet most of you don't, I'm hoping when we come back in 30 minutes, you're going to know what I'm referring to when we look at this picture. So this is Winchester. It was an exclusively white town. Inside it, I call it my white bubble. It looked like this in the 1960s. Does anyone know who this artist is? Norman Rockwell. So Norman Rockwell was a white illustrator who was charged with depicting the all-American life by the Saturday Evening Post, which is a widely consumed by white people journal in the era of my youth. And so these images were all over the place, not just in magazines, but on dentist office walls. And this is what life looked like for me. You know, in my neighborhood, my cousin's neighborhoods around New England, everywhere I went. And how convenient for me that what I was being told was the all-American life looked exactly like my life. So again, we're talking about a belief system. So nothing is out of whack here. Everything's sort of lining up for me. What's being done to me in this moment around my belief system that I have no idea is what sociologists and people who study neuropathways would say whiteness is being normalized. What that means is I'm not turning to my parents and saying, Mom, Dad, where is everybody? Come on. Like, why are all my teachers white and my classmates white? And our neighbors and the guy at the post office and the doctors and the nurses, like, why? Where is everybody? I'm not asking that question because this is so normal to me, I don't think to ask it. I'm not thinking, who am I not seeing? Whose voices am I not hearing? So whiteness is being normalized. Now, in my white bubble, in the 1960s, I did have access to the outside world. It looked like this. So in addition to whiteness being further normalized in through my TV shows, what else do you see being normalized in this image? They're so happy, which sounds kind of funny, but you know, if there's a really high value on being chipper and being happy, what's the implication about if you're angry or sad?
There's something wrong with you.
And, you know, in my household, us kids, we were told to go to your room and don't come out until you basically can be in polite company. I think about the way, you know, and I was very explicitly taught that people who were who complained, which is anyone who's angry, and people who complained were of poor character or poor rearing. So when I saw, for instance, the Vietnam protests, which was happening when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, I discredited all those people. I didn't even think about their message because the messenger was a group of people who had nothing better to do. They were poorly raised. They were poorly reared. So think about how that cut me off from really thinking about the messages that were all around me of complainers. What else being normalized in this image? What else do you see? And what's a traditional family? Right, so a couple kids. Yeah, we have so heterosexuality is being normalized. Having children is normalized. There was real stigma about childless couples or people who didn't get married. So this is what family looks like. I heard the word patriarchy. And, you know, father knows best. What's the implication there? Mother doesn't know best, kids don't know best. So there's amazing amount of information that we're always soaking up. Even if people aren't sitting down and telling you, we live in a patriarchal society. I didn't think I put an extra syllable in there. And it doesn't look like oppression or anything terrible. It's all very benign to me as a child. So I'm soaking up images like this. And I'll tell you, my mom and dad, I love my family. They had a beautiful marriage for 50 years until they both passed away of natural causes. My father gave my mother a $20 allowance every week. And I thought he was being so nice to her, to give her that money. I never would have said, wow, what an oppressive move. How disempowering for my mother. She's really being marginalized. So again, you know, what do we observe as children? What are we told? What are we not told? Sometimes those messages are just as strong. There's actually another one in here that's, I think, huge. Something else being normalized. What about those teeth? Have they had some dentistry, some orthodonture? So there's some class implications. You know, so what's being normalized is this is what, being all American, there's a certain class expectation. and material accumulation expectation. And we hear a lot these days about white people who are trapped in a cycle of poverty. So there's real discrimination and a feeling of otherness and being marginalized by many white people who this is an impossible attainment. If you kind of updated this to now. So much happens just through imagery. And it wasn't just the father knows best in my TV shows, but all through history as far as I could tell. And some people say, well, wait a minute, where's Barack Obama? And now where's Donald Trump? Well, let's say they're both there. Can we still say there's something of a pattern? And, you know, no one, when I am continually seeing white men who look educated and of a certain class status, I'm starting to form ideas about that this is actually a superior kind of human being. And thank goodness they're in charge and taking care of me. So I'm starting to internalize simultaneous ideas about white superiority and female inferiority. All of this just through these fleeting images and lack of conversation. So we had taboo topics in my household. Anyone else grow up with this saying, in polite company, we never discuss politics or religion? You couldn't begin to understand racism or sexism or patriarchy if you don't understand politics or religion, because they are foundational to it, which I had no idea. And meanwhile, while we're not talking about a lot of things, and I've got this massive information vacuum, I am being hammered over the head with language about that's hinting at this idea of a level playing field. Did anyone else grow up either being told or exposed to ideas that the special thing about the United States of America was the playing field was level? Yeah, so the fancy word is meritocracy. People make it or don't on their own merit. So how do we get these? What's the language that supports this ideology? Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Because the point is that we're all in pursuit of the American dream, and pulling yourself bootstraps is connected to that, because what do you have to do to attain the American dream? Just work hard. That's all. Work hard. And this is supported by some of our foundational documents, Life, Liberty, and Justice for Who? All, and Life, Liberty, Pursuit of Happiness. We've got Sweet Land of Liberty, some of the songs we sing. I was a public school kid. One Nation, Indivisible. So this was a really beautiful idea to me. It wasn't just an idea, but it was very core to my identity that I was in the best country in the whole world. This is post-World War II, Nazi Germany. And I am so proud to be an American. And all around me, this is affirmed, because in my white bubble, there was story after story about my great-grandparents came here from Italy, Poland, Germany, Russia, Ireland, with 2 cents in their pocket. They didn't speak a word of English. They were treated like dirt, and look at us now. And so this idea of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and reaching the American dream in the land of opportunity was totally real to me, and I had no counter stories. I had not a single story in my white bubble that told me anything else. So this is getting very firmly entrenched in my ideology, and I'm so proud, still proud to be an American, but I just now kind of understand there's more of a gap here. And some people say, well, Debbie, your story is really neat. I'm glad you're waking up, but my story is nothing like yours because I'm younger, I grew up in a different part of the country, I was poor, a diverse neighborhood, but I have to say, aren't we all exposed every day to the idea that some people are more valuable? There's some combination of identities that are more valuable in this country than others. And what do we do with that? To what degree are we unpacking it and understanding it? I say, yeah, I'm so down with racial justice. I mean, this is what I'm fighting for. This is the we, the people I want. But here's what I have to get real about, is that deep in my head, this is my we, the people. And by the way, this is a Google search, board of directors. I have no idea who these people are. But don't you know this image? Like I was like, oh, yeah, that's board of directors. That will do. So I saw this image all over my childhood. So to this day, you say, Debbie, shut your eyes and picture a group of investment bankers. This is who comes to mind. Never would these 50 entrepreneurs and investment bankers come to mind. Black entrepreneurs and investment bankers. Does anyone know who these 50 incredibly successful, wealthy black businessmen are? Really important chapter of United States history that I knew nothing about. Anybody in here know? So these are gentlemen from Black Wall Street, which was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. which I would never hear that in New England. But as we're getting closer to Tulsa, maybe people are familiar with the Greenwood neighborhood and the Greenwood, did I say that? Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma. So remember that thing about it just takes a generation or two to get a foothold and we can reach the American dream? Well, a couple generations after emancipation in the United States, there were black communities popping up all over the country. And often it would be just a smaller section of a city, a block or two, and there would be black families living there. There'd be mom and pop stores, gas stations, record stores. But that socioeconomic stability and traction was happening. Unfortunately, many of those neighborhoods across the country have been wiped out. Those neighborhoods are very intentionally wiped out in the Urban Renewal Program, which is dubbed the Negro Removal Program, because it was the black neighborhoods that were selected to be torn down to make ramps onto highways to bring white people out to suburbs. But in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that couldn't happen because it had become so huge. This was about 40 blocks. There were 600 businesses, 21 churches, 21 restaurants, 30 grocery stores, 2 movie theaters, 6 private airplanes, 1 hospital, 1 bank, and its own school system. This was one of the most affluent neighborhoods in all of the United States of America. Not black neighborhoods, neighborhoods, period. Okay, now, I was a history major. I never heard about this. I have an MBA. I sat in classrooms talking about Wall Street for 2 years. And I never heard about Black Wall Street. This isn't in my book because despite the years of research and writing I did, I never came across this until one day I accidentally put the word Wall Street in a Google window when the word black was already in there and this came up. And I thought it was some kind of a joke. I couldn't believe it was real. Like, how could I not know about this? And wouldn't it have been helpful for a little white girl who only ever saw white people to know that there were all kinds of people, not just in the United States, but around the globe, who were thriving, industrious? It would have countered a lot of negative stereotypes I was getting, but I never did hear about it. It wasn't in my history books. So I didn't know it existed, and I also never heard that it had been bombed and firebombed into extinction in the year 1921. So until 9/11, this was considered the number one act of domestic terrorism in the United States. It was a combination of private citizens in Tulsa, the KKK in Tulsa, the police in Tulsa got involved, the National Guard came in, got involved. There were airplanes dropping incendiary devices. So the entire neighborhood was wiped out. 15,000 people lost their homes and businesses forever. And I don't have there's discrepancy on the number of people who were killed, but how they were killed often was, it was the white citizens of Tulsa who were shooting and stabbing people as they fled their homes. John Legend is part of a group that's now making a TV series, and I'm not sure if it's fictionalized or documentary, that's going to be coming out in 2018 about this. So this is a huge piece of African-American history that has not been told. It's not just African-American history. That's interesting that that's what popped out of my mouth. That's white history. Or history. And if I don't know the degree of discrimination that's happened in this country, it made me a sitting duck to buy into incredible myths about the heroes and through the history of the United States who've been trying to speak and act up against white supremacy and racism, such as Dr. Martin Luther King. I knew he existed, but I thought he just had a dream. So that whole idea of imagining a day where we would judge each other not by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character, that fit beautifully with my colorblind mindset. But I didn't know anything about the vast organization he was a part of, about his work around the triple evils. I didn't know about his family's multi-generational work in the intersection of a pastoral family and an activist family. Didn't know any of that. And it allowed me to buy into the myth that I was taught that Rosa Parks was an old lady who sat down on a bus one day because she was tired. And then I went on and I taught that to my own children, and I was a elementary classroom teacher. I taught that to them too. In fact, Rosa Parks was a badass organizer. I know I'm in a church, sorry. And that day that she sat down on the bus, that was a one moment in an incredibly sophisticated strategy to spark the boycott. So she was not an old lady who sat down one day on a bus. I wish I had known. I knew Albert Einstein was a scientist. I knew Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, was this pioneering woman in the feminism front as a first lady. But I didn't know about the racial justice activism either of them had engaged in their life, which was really impressive. And it would have been nice for a young white girl to have some white heroes to look up to and know what it looks like to stand up against racial justice. So just all the ways I'm being held from information I need to be the kind of person I want to be and to create the kind of country that I'm being told I live in. I was completely not equipped to do that. I did know black people existed. I find it interesting in this image that I saw Gone with the Wind as a teenager, and what's notable to me is I didn't see it and say, why is a 17-year-old girl scolding her elder? So already by the time I'm a teenager, I'm buying into a social order, who, you know, social roles, and it's very much along racial lines. So how did all that get into my hard drive when I'm living in an all-white town? I've really looked deep. Here's just an example of the kinds of things I'm finding. Anyone know the Babar series? So I read the Babar books. I loved Babar. If you had said to me, is there anything racist about Babar? I would have said, no. Well, look what I'm about to show you. And I know I saw this page. When kids like something, they look at it multiple times, like hundreds of times. So in this scene, on one of the pages of one of the Babar books, these elephants are Babar's cousins, so they'd be the protagonists in the context of this story. And what the language is telling us is that the wild African cannibal savages have jumped out of the jungle and are attacking the elephants. So think of me. I'm a little girl growing up in an all-white community, and this is one of my very first exposures to people with darker skin than me. And it's completely attached to a narrative about primitive, savage, dangerous. And what degree does that set me up? Again, if we use our belief systems to collect evidence that supports what's already in there, to what degree does that set me up to go on and watch the evening news for years, decades, seeing the black guy doing the perp walk, and not say, why is it always a black guy? What is this pattern I'm observing? I'm not asking those questions because it makes perfect sense to me. These are savage, dangerous people. This is deep, deep in my belief system. And I don't even know it's there. It's just answering my questions faster than I can ask them. Maybe I even feel thankful that they're being locked up, these dangerous people. Look what's on the next page. Civilization. And civilization for me was only ever presented as white people. And so this narrative is such a huge piece of the American narrative. Who is savage? Who is civilized? And this savage role has been, white people have told other white people who is savage and who is not. And there have been multiple different ethnicities and racial groups cast in that savage role. I find it notable at this moment in history how many different groups are simultaneously cast as savage. But white is always the safe, innocent stereotype. This is, I'm being mindful of time. I may go a little over. This is an image that's important to me because I was, as a child growing up, we went to Maine every summer. We had a log cabin on a lake up there. And we would go to the dump as a family every Saturday morning. This was the big outing. And on the way to the dump, we would pass images just like this. I was told that the Indians had gone extinct because they drank themselves to death, but that some were left and they were really struggling, and that's who we were seeing on the way to the dump. And so one of the things we did as a family is when we went to the dump, we brought some stuff for the Indians. So for instance, one summer we replaced the screens on the log cabin because they were full of holes, but we didn't just toss them away. We neatly bound them up and we put some ribbon around them, and it was always the kids' job at the dump to go put that stuff off at the perimeter. And when we pulled away from the dump, the kids would look out the back window and see the Indians come and take our stuff. And I felt like such a good person because my family took the time to give away our secondhand stuff to people who apparently needed it. What a twisted story. And I'm going to tell you about one of the reasons it's so twisted to me. I actually had enough information in my belief system to understand how warped that story was. First, I'm going to share with you what else was in my belief system. Here's the state of Maine, and the red lines delineate land grants. My family got a big chunk of land right up here. My family started that town where my log cabin is. Can you hear the pride in my voice? My family founded a town. When I went up there, I was so excited to be in my family's town. But what never occurred to me was that while I was patting myself on the back for giving our secondhand stuff to the Indians, I was patting myself on the back for being generous to people who my ancestors had displaced. Their hardship was completely connected to all that was good in my life, much of what was good in my life. So why didn't I make that connection? Well, you know, I can understand at 5 or 10 or 15 years old, but I was a history major. I was 2 years into researching the book, Waking Up White, when I went to the White Privilege Conference and chose from all the things to go to a workshop called Free Land and sat down, and it was an hour in there listening to testimony by four indigenous people telling the story of what had happened to their families during the Homestead Act. As white people took free land, what happened to their histories? And I thought, oh my God, that's my story. For all the generations and all the years, my family was talking about this free land we'd gotten. It had never dawned on me to think, who else's family story might have been impacted by this moment in history? So this is the way that mythology gets perpetuated and other voices get completely what's called whitewashed. And I can understand why I didn't as a young child, but I think that at a certain point this is also going on for me, or it was. A reassuring lie is just so much more popular than an inconvenient truth. And so I still find when somebody presents me with something that doesn't feel good to me, my first response is to want to reject it because of this phenomenon. This is one piece of history, the one last piece of history I really want to lay down. And so my dad was in World War II. He was in the Navy. So there was this picture. There were lots of pictures around friends' homes. This is the 1960s and 70s. You couldn't escape knowing about World War II and all the heroes. This was a really popular picture, especially when we were teenagers. We liked this one. And I also knew about the GI Bill. So GI, for anyone who doesn't know, was the term used for a veteran back then. It still is sometimes interchangeable. I knew about the GI Bill because I knew, and what it is for anyone who doesn't know, and the way it was presented to me by my family was the government was taking care of its own. It was saying, thank you for going and fighting in World War II. When you come home, vets, we're going to give you free higher education, a small business loan if you want it, a farm loan if you want it. We're even going to give you a really low rate, no money down, government-backed mortgage to go buy your first home. I knew all this. I knew my dad had gone to Harvard Law School for free. I knew my parents bought that first home in Winchester, Massachusetts for $17,000. I knew that on the GI Bill. I knew that. But what I learned in my research that was so shocking, that the GI Bill wasn't accessible to the 1.2 million black GIs who also served in World War II. When I learned this, oh, wait a minute. Wait. There were 1.2 million black GIs in World War II? What, where were they in my history books and my movies and my TV shows and my novels? It had never occurred to me that there was anything but white men fighting in World War II. Through talks like this, I've learned that there weren't just 1.2 million black GIs. There were indigenous GIs and Latino GIs and Asian GIs, black and brown American citizens who went to fight in World War II, not all of whom came back, but for those who came back, they were not all, the black and brown GIs were mostly unable to access the GI Bill. And here's the really tricky part, is that it doesn't say anywhere in the GI Bill that it's all white. Here's how it worked. On the school front, at the time, there was a quota system. So at universities and colleges, so 2 black spots, 2 Jewish spots, 2 Chinese spots, 2 fill in the blank spots. And those filled up. But for someone like my dad, there was endless capacity to choose what he wanted to study, where he wanted to study. I have heard that historically black colleges and universities were able to absorb some of the black GIs who returned. But there was another complicating factor for many black and brown returning GIs, and that has to do with the Social Security bill. So my father comes back. He doesn't have to worry about supporting his parents or my mother's parents. They're doing fine on Social Security, which is a prior racialized bill. How is Social Security racialized? In its original form, it excluded domestic and agricultural workers, who were disproportionately black and brown. So you start to see the multi-generational compounding of disadvantage for black and brown families and multi-generational opportunity and advantage for white families. So that's what happened on the school front. 4% of black and brown GIs were able to access the housing portion, I mean the education portion. So what happened on the housing front? Well, in the 1930s, the Federal Housing Authority invented that thing we so comfortably now call the mortgage. Until then, you had to buy your home outright, or maybe put 50% down and get a deal with your local friendly banker. But the FHA said, hey, we're going to be pumping a lot of money through the GI Bill into housing and create all this economic opportunity in our country. We're going to create this thing called the mortgage so that regular everyday people can get a loan to go buy a residential property. So the FHA, arm of our government, turns to private banks across the country and says, when you're making these new loans called mortgage, we're going to give you two things we want you to consider about when you're considering lending risk. One, condition of the building. Makes sense to me. Who wants to invest in or make a loan into a building that's falling apart? Condition number two says the United States federal government, through the FHA guidelines, the presence of even one or two non-white families can undermine real estate values. And so with that warning in mind, private banks all over the country lay out maps of their areas, and they engage in a practice called redlining. So what we see here is Minneapolis's version. They have a legend, which is why I pulled this. So the red areas, is red considered a hazardous investment, green area considered the best investment. Black people live here. White people live here. We've got blue is still desirable, so probably some racial mix here. Yellow is definitely declining. You know what that means? The black folks are moving in and the white folks are moving out. That GI Bill was only good in the green areas. So a black GI could not access the housing portion because it was only good in white-only areas thanks to this banking lending structure. So cities all over the country have engaged in this, hundreds of them. You think about, you know, this was, some people might say this is a long time ago, but these housing footprints are very much still intact. That's my city. So to give you a sense of what this means materially, that GI Bill, and I'm going to give you a figure based in dollars in 140s dollars, I mean 1940s dollars, $120 billion. Of money went from United States government coffers into the hands of private citizens just through the GI Bill housing benefit. I don't know if we did a time value crunch what that number would be now, but it went 98% of that went to white families like mine. And so you think about, you know, think about how different these were invested in, and these were basically economically castrated. Think about how different these neighborhoods are. But I don't know any of this, and I come out of my little white bubble childhood and college life, and I end up working in arts and education in the Boston area, and I encounter a neighborhood like this. What do you think my belief system tells me? They are not working hard. Maybe all these other stereotypes, lazy, not very smart, don't care about education, criminals, don't take care of their property. So all of these negative narratives I have been fed throughout my life, and all it takes is hearing it once. And if my belief system already believes something like this, it catches it. And that's how I interpret this. Never do I think these are two outcomes of a single policy. And though I was very comfortable, by the way, what I was doing was I was creating after-school programs for inner-city youth. I was using the word under-resourced very comfortably, but I wasn't saying, yeah, I'm from Winchester, this over-resourced town. Yet now I look at these two pictures and I can hear this giant sucking sound. So this is economic castration in order to fund towns like this. And you think about, you know, this is the public library. That's the town hall. Those are public buildings. What do we have here for public buildings? And how is public education funded? Property tax. Where do we think the better schools are? So it's a real difference in educational access and opportunity. It's a difference in air quality. It's a difference in recreational opportunity. There's a different food supply that gets shipped out to each of these neighborhoods. There are different transportation opportunities in these neighborhoods. And granted, these are something, two ends of a spectrum, but that redlining really made that spectrum pretty kind of checker blocky as opposed to a real continuum. So this is kind of the way I came out of my childhood, because I wasn't thinking dangerous criminal. I was thinking inferior, need to be helped and fixed. So remember me saying I knew there was an elephant in the room and maybe I wasn't appreciated, but I didn't know that I was the elephant or my ignorance was the elephant. So I also had no idea of the history I was enacting. Does anyone know who this incredibly helpful white woman is? This is Manifest Destiny. So this is the painting that accompanies that period in U.S. history that's American Progress. So Manifest Destiny is the language given to the prevailing narrative of the time, which was that white European people who landed on this continent were God's chosen people, and it was their Christian mission to spread that Christian message and their overall goodness and morality all the way westward to the Pacific Ocean. So she's got a Bible under her arm. She's floating over the westward plain. So it justified, during that westward expansion, it justified the Mexican-American War, in which a huge chunk of Mexico suddenly becomes the states of Texas, New Mexico, Southern California, Arizona, and Southern California. And all of those people who were once Mexican are suddenly U.S. subjects. Now, you think about the Mexican-Americans who went to fight World War II to stand up for their country, to come back and not be able to access the benefits. Westward expansion also justified the displacement of all the indigenous people along the way. And displacement is a pretty sanitized word because it's a very violent history. And the hardest piece of this history for me to stomach is what happened to the children. So as in any juncture in a society, as this project, this westward expansion, is happening, there are all these conversations happening around the country about what are we going to do about the Indian problem. And there were some people with some kind of extermination-oriented solutions. But there was a white man in Pennsylvania who stood up and said, you know what? I think I have an idea. I think we can save these people. If we just kill the Indian, we can save the man. That was his language. He said, if we can get them young enough and we can wipe out all that Indianness, I think we can make these people real people. So as these people are being separated from their homes, the children are taken and they are brought to Indian boarding schools. So this is the very first Indian boarding school started by that white man, Richard Pratt. This is the Carlisle Indian Boarding School. There would go on to be hundreds of them all across the United States. So what happened is that these children got separated from their adults. So think about that for a minute. Transported sometimes hundreds of miles, and when they arrive, they are greeted by white people who think that they're really dirty creatures. And so the first thing they do is cut their hair, remove their clothing, and scrub them clean in a kerosene water solution. And then they give them these little Anglo uniforms, they give them an Anglo name, and they give them a Bible, and they're given very strict instructions. You do not speak until you can speak English. So imagine being simultaneously traumatized and told not to talk. And if one of these children spoke in their native tongue, which I would, wouldn't you want to turn to someone and say, what's going on? How long are we going to be here? Speaking in your native tongue resulted in punishment. Maybe a mouth washed out with lye and sometimes a snip to the tongue. So I hope I've created some impact. Because when I was taught history, nobody once ever asked me to feel. As if it's just dates and memorizing, when what we're doing is we're changing human lives and ignoring human atrocities. So I would ask you at this moment to just pause and check in with yourself. What are you feeling? And if you can capture what you're feeling with one word, I'm going to walk to the back of the room and then this way. And if you want to offer up your word, I'll repeat it for everybody to hear. And let's kind of take the pulse of the room. What is this room? What is the range of feeling, physical feeling, emotional feeling in this room right now?
Anger.
Disgust.
Shame.
Heartbreak.
Sadness.
Educated.
Outrage.
Embarrassment.
Guilt.
Sickness.
Shock.
Disturbed.
Duty.
Overwhelmed.
Sick.
Just sick.
Surprise.
Polarized.
So think about the challenge of teaching this in schools, because educators would have to hold this kind of emotion, and then kids would go home and tell their parents, this is harder than teaching sex ed. But if it doesn't get taught, the mythology gets perpetuated and the omissions get perpetuated. It's a major challenge in our country. And so I do work with schools, but faith communities are a place where we can start to think about how do we do this in our own families? How do we get these conversations going in our circles of friends? Not just our faith communities, but our circles of friends and maybe with our grandchildren and our children. How do we stop this perpetuation of myth-making? Where some children grow up feeling inferior and other children grow up feeling superior? Talk about polarizing. I have just a very short thing because I knew I was supposed to stop early.
Just a little bit of information. Debbie's talk here was extremely condensed. I attended her session yesterday, or I guess it was whatever, and it was 2.5 hours, and that was condensed, I know, because she has a lot to cover. And so that's in a way I didn't stop for questions, because we can ask questions back afterwards, but I know she has a lot to say, and we have a lot to hear.
And I do. While the offering's going around, what I usually do, if we had more time, I would give you some, because at this point, a lot of white people say, oh my God, tell me what to do. So I'm going to give you a suggestion about that. But before I do, one of the things I want to note is that often when I'm in a room that's more racially mixed, some of those words that I get, because these words are all very typical of what I hear, but sometimes I hear, thank you, finally, relieved. Because can you imagine if one of these stories, these histories I'm talking about, is in your family history, or you just know it, you've been educated around it, but you can't speak that truth to your colleagues and your friends, your classmates, if you're a kid, because you won't get believed, you'll be considered a complainer, and you'll be ostracized. So this is why, if we want to get away from a state of polarization, one thing we can do is start to find our shared history. And when we're thinking about history, always look for multiple sides. So here's my quick version of tell me what to do. Oh, wait, no. Some people say this is ancient history. And I say, well, actually, it's not that ancient. Like, we're standing on stolen land right now. Some people's history would say stolen. White Privilege Conference starts sessions and every day with a blessing by indigenous people saying, thank you for being on my land. I'm so glad you're doing this important work here. And I bless you. You can use my land today to do this important work. But recognize that it is stolen, and we are asking for healing. You know, what would it look like to start every church service that way? And of course, the younger generation that's coming up is not so content to not talk about it. So white students are going, this next generation is going to get a lot of pushback, the white students. Education is learning what you didn't even know. You didn't know, that's my motto. And that's my paradigm shift, because it's a paradigm shift. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., who is the founder of the White Privilege Conference, and I, along with another colleague, Dr. Marguerite Parks, we've created something called the 21-Day Racial Equity Habit Building Challenge. It lives on my website. We've got all kinds of resources, and we ask people for 21 days, do something every single day to increase your education, build your racial justice muscle. We've made it really easy for you with links to everything. We even have a little scorecard on there. White people love competition even with themselves. A little scorecard to keep track of what you're doing. And the idea is that neurology, remember I talked about neuropathways? To build a new habit, neuroscience tells us it takes 21 days. So, in the name of, I think what we should do is stop this. Normally what I do at this point, if I have another half an hour, people get into groups of 4 to 6 and they start talking about their own histories. I used to do question and answer, but I think often people are done with me talking and want to talk themselves. What do you think we should do? Are people wanting to go?
Well, we're almost at the point where we have to stop because of the church service.
Thanks for your attention. Sorry I went over, but so much to talk about.
Debbie, thank you so very much. Now, in lieu of an honorarium, we have a custom here. We have the All Souls mug made in America for you.
Not China?
No, not China. It's made in America.
Beautiful.
And we all want to thank you for taking of your time and sharing with us.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation. I'm a good person. Isn't that enough? This program was recorded on Sunday, April 30th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Fraser. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.